The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we'll take a break from the dire predictions about climate change and take a more hopeful look at some of the technology that just might help us turn it around. We'll talk to reporter and columnist Tyler Hamilton about his new book, Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Inventors and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy. But first, let's learn about the role that patents play in the development of new technology. I'm here with Jason Rantanen, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law, where he teaches patent law. He has his master's degree in history and his law degree from the University of Chicago. He's also co-author of the widely read law blog, Patently O. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Jason.
Thank you.
Now, we want to talk about the role that patents play in the development of new technology, but I do want to make sure that everyone knows what we're talking about. So first of all, what is a patent?
A patent is, at the most basic level, a government-issued property right in new technology and new inventions. And what it gives the inventor is it gives the inventor the right to exclude others from practicing that technology. It's a right to exclude, not a right to practice a technology. So a company like a pharmaceutical company that develops a new drug product and has a patent on that drug can't sell the drug just because it has a patent. It has to get FDA approval to do that, but it can exclude others from making or selling or using that particular drug. Now, that's the conceptual idea of a patent. A patent is actually a document that the government publishes, and the document has basically two main portions. It has a description of what the new invention is. We call that the specification. And it ends with a set of claims that define what the inventor is entitled to exclude others from practicing. It's these claims that really are the heart of the patent. We think oftentimes we hear a new patent, like the Amazon one-click patent.
Right.
We think, wow, that's a really broad patent. But when you get down to the claims themselves, they're often written in very technical language that limits the scope of that idea to a particular application, a particular practical application.
So what kinds of things would then qualify for a patent?
There's a lot of things that
right.
qualify for a patent. And the basic rule, one of the requirements of patentability, is that it has to constitute patentable subject matter. But the thing about what's patentable subject matter is that the basic idea is anything under the sun that's made by man has to be created by human beings. But other than that, we pretty much let patents issue on almost any new invention, any new technology.
So then what are the basic requirements for an invention to be patentable?
And there are some things that are excluded from subject matter, laws of nature, physical phenomena. We don't give patents on those. Aside from those broad restrictions, though, a new invention has to be novel. So it can't be something that someone else has done before. We only give patents on new inventions. And there has to be some type of non-trivial variation beyond the prior art. So the invention can't be obvious in light of what other people have done before. Those are the two main requirements. And I think the two requirements that most strongly constrain what is actually patentable. In addition, a patent has to be useful. So a new technology has to have some practical utility, but that utility requirement is pretty minimal.
So that non-obvious part, that's interesting. So does that mean that there has to be a little bit of inspiration involved?
Perhaps. It's a concept that is very fluid and difficult to capture very clearly. I mean, you think of the idea of obvious, it can vary. Obvious in light of what? Obvious to whom? Well, obvious to a person in this particular technological area, obvious to a brilliant person, obvious to a skilled mechanic. It's a very fluid concept.
Mm.
And historically, certainly, there's been this sense there has to be a little bit of genius maybe in it. Although this historical ideas has very much been pushed back by some courts, by Congress, and some of the patent statutes to say, well, you know, we're also going to allow people who work really hard, who engage in small incremental research, they should also be entitled to a patent if it's not something that would immediately be obvious to that person of ordinary skill in the art. So it's not really much of an answer because there isn't really much of an answer. The idea of obviousness is so fluid. It's something that courts and scholars and lawyers have really struggled with trying to put some type of constraint, some type of structure on, and really been unsuccessful.
The patent isn't protecting an idea itself. It's more like the actual physical expression of the idea.
I would say more a practical, useful expression of the idea. Because a patent can be on a process or a method in addition to a device or composition of matter. It might, for example, be on a process for making steel or a process for performing a particular diagnostic test. So I think of a patent more as an exclusive right over a new technology, where the technology really is some kind of practical aspect to it.
Well, then where do genes come in? Because a gene isn't a technology, is it?
Genes are a fascinating thing to look at in light of patent law.
Well, we can patent those, correct? Just to be clear for anybody who doesn't know that.
Can patent genes, but there are certain constraints. So, for example, we can patent isolated genes, genes that have been taken out of the strand of DNA, out of the chromosome, and isolated to just that particular gene. We can also patent various different types of products of that gene. We can patent the RNA that's produced by that gene. So there's lots of levels to look at when you say, can we patent genes? There's all sorts of things to think about there. But at the bottom line, if you're right, we can patent genes. We can patent isolated genetic information. Where I have the sense that you're going is that, is a gene a manufacture? Is it a human product? That's an issue that is very much the subject of thought by academics and really by courts right now. There's a case that the Federal Circuit, which is the federal court that hears all appeals relating to patent issues, there's a case that the Federal Circuit just recently decided relating to the patentability of genes where it said, yes, isolated DNA is patentable. Now, the Supreme Court is likely going to address this issue as well. And so while genes can be patented right now, we'll see what the Supreme Court does with that particular issue.
Well, maybe help me with that. What's the rationale behind that? Like, for example, I couldn't patent an element because I found it first, could I?
No, you could not patent an element that you found first. Although if you created that element, you might be able to patent it. So, for example, if there's a new element, an element very high on the periodic table, mm-hmm. that didn't exist in anywhere on Earth, that no one had created before, there's not really a good reason why it couldn't be patented if it was created by a human being and didn't exist in nature. On the other hand, let's say that you were the first person to find iron lying there on the ground. You wouldn't be able to patent that. That's a discovery. That's a thing of nature that was you just found. Is a gene like that, though? That's the ultimate mm-hmm. question. Is a gene like, say, picking a leaf off of a tree? Is it essentially the same thing to taking something that was in nature and just isolating it? That's the fundamental line here. That's the issue as to whether or not genes can be patented is, are they so much like something that already exists in nature? Or do they require some type of man-made intervention that's so great that we say, yes, we're going to let people get patents on them, because if we don't let people get patents on them, no one's going to go out and isolate these genes. No one's going to take these isolated genes and develop useful products, useful medical treatments, useful techniques based on that isolated gene.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Jason Rantanen, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. His scholarship focuses on the use of mental state elements in patent law and the intersection between patent law and innovation theory. Now, what you were just talking about, it's one of the basic points of patent law is the idea that it's supposed to give inventors an incentive to innovate, correct?
Yes, that's a fundamental justification for patent law, and probably the most powerful justification is that inventors oftentimes invent in order to receive a reward. They may invent for other reasons too. There's no suggestion anywhere in the patent law that people won't engage in scientific endeavors, won't engage in discovery, won't engage in invention, absent a patent system. But what a patent system does is it gives them a real financial incentive to invest resources in developing new technologies and thus accelerating the pace of technological progress. There's other justifications for the patent system too. There's the idea that in return for receiving a patent, the inventor is obligated to disclose their new technology to the public, thus giving the public information about a technology that it wouldn't have had. And that's this requirement that the inventor, in addition to defining what their invention is in the claims, also has to describe how to make and use that new invention in the specification. And finally, the third main justification for the patent system is that it gives companies a reason to develop new technologies, not to invent new technologies, but take those new inventions, invest the resources necessary to bring them to market, turn them into valuable goods that society can use. There's a sense that without patents, the first person to put a new product on the market will instantly be copied by competitors and will really have lost any investment that they made to develop that new product, to commercialize that new product.
How well do you think patent law does it actually promoting innovation?
Overall, I think the patent system has clearly played a fundamental role in enhancing and encouraging technological progress over the last two centuries. The pace of technological progress has grown rapidly. It's a bit difficult, though, because how do we say if there was no patent system, technology wouldn't be the same place? We can't engage in that experiment, unfortunately. But we can engage in a thought exercise and think about what would happen if there was no patent system to certain types of inventions, like, for example, inventions whose operation is very clear once they're actually put into the marketplace. The chair, for example. Think about the first creator of a chair. Creates the chair, places the chair in the marketplace. Everyone else starts making chairs at that point. The inventor really has no incentive to even create the first chair. He'd probably be better off mining some ore or farming or doing something else with his time rather than trying to invent. That's where the patent system has really succeeded, is in terms of inventions whose operation is readily apparent once they're placed in the marketplace. We call these self-disclosing inventions, inventions where it's impossible to keep secret their workings, as opposed to secret inventions, inventions like commercial processes, where inventors can maintain the secrecy of that invention while still using it to make a profit, to monetize that invention. So I think at the end, I think the patent system has succeeded as a whole. Now, do I think that there are ways in which the patent system could be more successful? Yes. Do I think that there are individual circumstances within the patent system where the patent system doesn't work? Absolutely. But as a whole, I think the patent system works very effectively at encouraging technological progress.
Particularly in software patents is what I'm thinking of. There's been a lot of talk that they're being used to stifle innovation. So maybe let's talk about patent trolls.
We originally thought of patent trolls as simply non-practicing entities, entities who obtained a patent but didn't actually make or use the technology of the patent in any productive sense. And this idea served to capture an entity that was extracting rents from actual producing entities, that was extracting money or resources from those actual producing entities. But this idea had some problems with it. And the problem is that many inventors don't necessarily want to produce their technology. They want to license it or give it to an actual producing entity. Some people prefer to invent. Some people prefer to manufacture and produce. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. where the idea of the patent troll came into play was where an inventor would obtain a patent, not really engage in any type of disclosure activities with regard to that technology, wait until others independently develop that technology, use that technology to begin producing goods, established a market for it, and then, at that point, sprung the patent on this unsuspecting producing entity. So a patent troll isn't just an entity that holds patents without producing anything or using that technology, but there's also this idea of surprise, that the patent troll is able to exploit weaknesses in the patent system in order to surprise actual productive entities.
Now, what effect have patent trolls, I love that name, had on tech companies?
Well, they certainly created costs for these companies in a number of different ways. On the one hand, there's the cost of dealing with patent trolls. So what patent trolls are doing is they're extracting undeserved rents. They haven't contributed anything to society. A true patent troll doesn't contribute anything. They just take. They just impose costs on companies. Those costs are going to affect the financial well-being of that company. They'll probably be reflected in prices. They'll generally impose a drag on society. There's also the cost of fighting patent trolls. So some companies, rather than paying off patent trolls, have instead chosen to fight, to be aggressive against the patent trolls as a defensive strategy, make themselves a very hard target so that the patent trolls will go after softer targets in the future. But even that has its costs, because lawyers are expensive, litigation is extremely expensive, and it takes time and energy away from the actual productive activities that the company is engaging in. So what patent trolls have done is they've created these costs. They've introduced new inefficiencies into actual technological progress, into actual productive activities, without providing anything in return.
So would you say that they are automatically bad for innovation then?
Well, the difficulty with patent trolls is actually defining who is a patent troll and saying that this particular entity is solely imposing costs. There's a number of examples of companies that have been labeled as trolls while at the same time seeming to develop new technologies. Rambus is a classic example of a company that has certainly been called a patent troll, yet at the same time, Rambus's technology is arguably at the core of modern RAM memory.
Mm-hmm.
Some instances, it's fairly clear that this entity really did keep its technology secret until others independently developed it, and then, after years have passed, asserted the patents. But in most cases, it's difficult to say, is this really an entity that has provided something to society, or is this an entity that is just imposing costs on society?
Are there any other kind of patent trolls that aren't software-oriented?
Well, software and technology are certainly the primary areas of troll-like activity. The pharmaceutical industry is an area that's not as susceptible to trolls, at least as the economy is currently structured. And this has to do with the enormous costs that are required to develop new drug products. The only way to get a patent in the pharmaceutical industry is to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars in order to develop a new pharmaceutical product, send it through rigorous testing. And that's just not an environment that is very conducive to trolls obtaining patents on small incremental advances that they can later assert.
Now, does a patent actually have to be shown to work before it can be given out?
There is a requirement that technology actually has to work. That's part of the utility requirement. However, there's a presumption that new technologies and patents do actually work. Now, that's a presumption that can certainly be overcome by the patent examiner, the person at the patent office who evaluates whether or not a patent should be given out on this new invention. For example, a few years ago, someone submitted a patent for cold fusion, and the examiner presented some evidence that says no one thinks cold fusion can work. You have to prove to us that cold fusion actually works. And in that circumstance, of course, they couldn't prove that the cold fusion described in the patent actually worked, and so no patent was given. In most circumstances, though, the examiner isn't going to press on the utility requirement. There's not enough time in the examiner's day to force every single inventor to prove that their invention actually works when most inventions are actually going to work. The examiner can better focus his or her time on looking for prior art, seeing whether or not this invention has been done by others, rather than assessing the issue of utility.
So technically, if someone came in and wanted a patent on a potentially brilliant new technology that they just couldn't prove yet worked, they wouldn't be able to get a patent.
That's absolutely right. And there have been cases like that in the past where the technology wasn't quite there. They couldn't actually make it work yet, and people aren't entitled to patents in that circumstance. There has to be an actual working technology. It doesn't have to be created. So there's no requirement that one build the particular invention in question. But if it's such a cutting-edge technology that there's evidence that it won't work, or at least a strong belief that it's not going to work, in those circumstances, proof that it actually works is going to be required.
Patents are weird, sir.
Sometimes they are, but they're also really critical to technological advancement, so they play an important role.
Thanks very much for being here, Jason.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about Professor Jason Rantanen and his blog Patently O on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be back with Tyler Hamilton, author of the new book, Mad Like Tesla, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Tyler Hamilton, writer for the Toronto Star and author of Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Inventors and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy. Welcome, Tyler.
Thank you.
Now, you say that no one has proven more people wrong over the last 100 years than Nikola Tesla. So he's best known for the alternating current induction motor, but at a certain point, people thought that that was an impossible idea.
Well, I think just at the time, people couldn't wrap their heads around it. There are certain preconceived notions of how things were at the time, and a young Tesla had kind of gone through his idea with his professor at the time, and his professor had this knee-jerk reaction and dismissed it as a perpetual motion machine, even though it had nothing to do with perpetual motion. But he just couldn't wrap his head around the concept, so it was dismissed. And for several years after, Tesla had to really prove that this was the way to go and go up against industrial titans like Thomas Edison to prove that his approach was superior.
Well, Thomas Edison actually tried to discourage its use, didn't he?
Well, yeah, because he was trying to perfect direct current energy generation. He had this idea that you could have more of a distributed model, actually, something that we're kind of looking at more today. But back then, his model was that different neighborhoods and different industrial plants would have their own power generation, and the electricity would be distributed over short distance through direct current, which is much, much safer. Tesla, his concept allowed for the long-distance distribution of electricity. The only problem is you're dealing with very, very dangerous voltages and currents, and Edison used that against Tesla and tried to prove that alternating current was too dangerous to embrace as a standard. And basically, it became a war against these two inventors to try to see which would become the standard for electricity generation.
And I didn't realize before that Tesla was also the father of radio?
The problem with Tesla is that he often didn't promote the things that he did. Other people were better at trying to get out there and show the world what they were working on. So Marconi was actually credited for early wireless communications. But this was challenged and actually in the U.S. Supreme Court, it determined that Tesla indeed had the original patents for early wireless transmission. And he's still not recognized to date for that. There's still a huge component of the community who attributes that to Marconi, but in fact it was Nikola Tesla.
And he had many other ideas and inventions as well. But what was the general perception of him while he was coming up with all of these ideas?
Well, it really depends at what stage he was in his life and what the particular idea was. When he was an older gentleman, he became more quirky, and he started to earn this reputation as a mad scientist. In his early years, it was interesting. He had lots of followers and people who were genuinely impressed with his mind and some of the things that he was coming up with. But when he started talking about ideas of world transmission of power through wireless means and having this wireless, not just communications distribution, but power distribution, people couldn't wrap their heads around it. But in fact, when you think about some of the things that he thought of, you know, whether it was just him talking or him actually doing, a lot of it's come true today. There's times when he was being quoted in newspapers at the time talking about people being on ships and being able to, you know, listen to baseball games and listen to presidential speeches, you know, from distant nations. And I guess people at the time thought this was fantastic. You know, there's no way this would ever happen. But of course, we take that for granted today. It exists. So he was very much a visionary. And in his time, coming up with these ideas, he was written off by many people as a little bit of a kooky, mad scientist. And in fact, one of the first, I guess, villains in the Superman movie cartoons was a mad scientist named Tesla. So that became part of the early culture.
Well, your book, Mad Like Tesla, examines some clean energy technologies that maybe years down the road we may or may not look at the same way as we now look at Tesla's work. So how hard overall was it to separate the potential genius from the crazy?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the title Mad Like Tesla, it's not that everybody in the book I consider mad. And in fact, I don't consider any of them mad. Mad is something that I put in there to show what other people might think of them.
Right.
You know, it's more of a perception of what they're working on rather than whether they're really crazy or not. Because, in fact, most of the stories I talk about, I think that they're genuine. They're really onto something. And the problems that they have at various stages of their development is that people can't envision these things coming to fruition, either because they don't see society accepting it. Maybe there's a perception of safety issues involved. Maybe they don't think that it's ever going to be economical. Maybe they think, you know, the inventor is a little bit too... truly not crazy, but an oddball, and that they're never going to get people on their side to go up against the big oil companies and the big gas companies. The companies I used as examples, they are at various stages of their development, from early to the point where they don't even have a prototype, all the way up to somebody who's actually got pilot projects built, and they're just waiting for the large-scale financing to make it a commercial reality.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm on the line with Tyler Hamilton. Tyler's award-winning weekly column, Clean Break, explores trends, issues, and technologies in the clean technology and green energy market. He's also the author of Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Inventors and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy. Well, let's start off with cold fusion. Now, this idea is frequently used as an example of science getting it all wrong or maybe getting too excited before it is appropriate.
Well, of course, back in the 80s, there's that whole scandal around Pons and Fleischmann. They had assembled everybody, all the press, at a press conference to announce that they had cracked the cold fusion nugget, the ability to, I guess, create more energy than what they put in through a non-chemical reaction in a kind of a room temperature environment. And they had talked about how this was going to change the world, and, you know, within a decade we'd have sources of power generation that would be clean and wouldn't come with the kind of toxic and long-lived radioactive materials that come with traditional nuclear fission. So the world got kind of excited, except that after many different groups tried to replicate these experiments, they just couldn't do it. And a large comprehensive report came out by the U.S. government saying that this, in fact, wasn't real. There's no evidence to substantiate their claims. And I guess the media got a little bit ticked off because they felt that they had kind of gotten pulled into this and embarrassed by their coverage. And since then, there hasn't been any real interest in cold fusion. There's been work going on behind the scenes, but it doesn't get any kind of mainstream coverage. And in fact, it's heavily ridiculed. There's a group of scientists And they're generally treated like lepers, you know, in the nuclear community. So, but they are there, and they are working away, and they are making progress. But at the moment, it hasn't attracted any mainstream media attention, largely because it's this cry wolf syndrome. You know, the media's been there once. It ended up being a scam. They don't want to come back to it.
So much so that the U.S. Patent Office has actually stopped granting patents on cold fusion research.
Yeah, that's, you know, basically they just don't want to waste their time going through the documentation. They don't believe it's possible.
Well, tell us about General Fusion.
Well, General Fusion is a company that's attempting nuclear fusion, but they're not taking the cold fusion approach. They're actually taking an approach that was first conceived of by the U.S. Naval Research Academy back in mid-1970s. And what it is it's kind of a hybrid between the two conventional approaches to fusion today. One approach is that you try to compress plasma of deuterium and tritium. You can either compress it with lasers or contain it within these massive electromagnets and then heat it up to the point where you achieve ignition and you get net gain, which is that you're getting more energy out than you put in. The approach with the huge magnets, it's being approached by the group called ITER in Europe. It's a big international consortium. They hope to achieve this net gain sometime in the next couple of decades at a cost of $30 billion, while there's a group in California at the National Ignition Facility that's using this laser-based approach, and their research is a little less focused, but they are attempting to achieve net gain as well. And then, of course, billions of dollars are being spent on this. Now, what these guys in Vancouver, British Columbia, are trying to do is create basically a mechanical fusion reactor. I guess another way to call it is a thermal nuclear diesel engine. And it's the injection of plasma into this sphere that contains a liquid lead-lithium mixture that's spinning around really, really fast, and it creates this air gap through the center, kind of like a tornado running through the center of air. Plasma goes into the center, and then they have these massive rams that mechanically slam the outside of the metal sphere, sending a sonic wave, a shock wave, through the lead-lithium mixture towards the center to the point where the shock wave compresses the plasma. You create the fusion, it releases the energy, and then you collect the heat. So that's the approach in a nutshell. It's completely doable, and in fact, this was patented in the 70s, as I said. The problem is at the time, the software, the digital control systems, the digital signal processing didn't exist at the time to do it with the type of accuracy that was needed. But fast forward 30 years, and these guys at this company called General Fusion have the wherewithal, and the technology exists today to do this. So they're actually going ahead and building such a reactor, and they hope to prove that they can achieve net gain by about 2016.
Now, what General Fusion is proposing is completely different than what Pons and Fleischmann were proposing. But when I just took a quick look on Google about General Fusion, a lot of people are putting this in the cold fusion category. So why is that?
Well, just because it's new. It's anybody attempting to do something different, and especially if you're just a bunch of guys with venture capital trying to do it in your, you know, these guys aren't doing it in a basement.
Right.
In a warehouse somewhere, but it's not an international consortium. A lot of people think that, oh, you know, you're trying to crack the fusion nut. You know, you can't do that with just a handful of engineers in Canada. You know, you have to be part of a bunch of lab coat wearing PhDs who are spending $30 billion over 3 decades to actually do this. People just have this perception that it's fusion. It's too hard for just a bunch of guys to do in some warehouse. It's got to be done at this international level. And so it's immediately dismissed. But these guys have some former U.S. Department of Energy PhDs who have retired. They're in their corner. They've reviewed their work. They've said it's not impossible, which is actually a good endorsement. And they've had engineers at Bombardier look at it from the actual materials perspective, and they gave it a thumbs up, said there's no showstoppers in this. So really, they just have to raise the money, about $50 million, to prove that they can do it. And so far, they had a rough road at the beginning, but they're starting to attract some venture capital money. And one of their most recent investors is Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com.
Right.
So they're starting to get some traction now.
We have a question via email from Lindsay.
What about actual fusion? hasn't that been 10 to 20 years away for about 40 years now?
Well, yeah, it's true. Actually, it's been longer than 40 years. It stretches back about 60 or 70 years now. Yeah, it's one of those forever emerging technologies, and that is true. But at the same time, we have made lots of advances. And I think that what happens is, and again, it's this kind of boy who cries wolf thing, right? Is every time you have a press conference to say you've made a big breakthrough and then it proves out to be a fake, people increasingly lose interest, and then the story kind of drops to, you know, behind the scenes. But it doesn't mean that the research stops. And you can talk to any of these well-respected academics out there who are doing serious research in the fusion area, whether it's cold fusion or whether it's the type of thing that General Fusion's doing, or whether it's just conventional fusion, and they'll tell you that there's some significant strides being made. The problem that I have with the big international consortium approach is that it's so bureaucratic. It takes forever for them to do things. You know, the guy, Michel Laberge, who is the founder of General Fusion, once joked to me when I was interviewing him for the book that General Fusion is hoping to prove net gain before the guys at ITER can build the toilets in the facility, you know, over at their reactor facility in France.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Tyler Hamilton, author of Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Inventors and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy. So cold fusion is a really striking example of what could be a clean energy breakthrough, could be, let's say. And at least it's something that lay people have heard about, and we can kind of wrap our heads around that. But some of the technologies that you talk about in the book are completely new to me, like tornado power.
Yeah, and I wouldn't throw tornado power in the category of going to save all of the world's problems.
Right.
But if you think of, you know, our approach to energy, solving the energy problem as instead of being a silver bullet, being silver buckshot, I think it's one of the things that we can do to deal with our energy problems. So the tornado power guy, it's a guy in Sarnia, Ontario, who is a retired refinery engineer. And for the past 30, 40 years of his life as a pet project, he has been interested in harnessing the power of rising air, you know, convection, and what he sees naturally, you know, through the formation of tornadoes. He's always had this idea that you could create a man-made tornado and then harness the energy from it. And he's just kind of gone about it through, you know, his own spare time. He's built these very small garage-sized prototypes to show in principle that you can stimulate the early creation of a tornado. His ultimate idea is you would take a 500 megawatt coal plant. It produces a lot of waste heat because burning coal in a coal plant is very inefficient. You maybe use a third of the energy and two-thirds of it is released as waste heat. So his idea is that you would capture that waste heat and you would pump it into this big concrete arena that's like a cooling tower for a nuclear plant. And the hot air would be pushed in at a tangent and it would start to spin inside this Colosseum-type structure. And then as it was spinning, it would rise. And as it rises, it will eventually connect with the cooler air up top through the opening in the top. And then the idea, in principle, is that you would start to trigger the formation of a tornado. And then once that tornado created a life of its own, instead of pushing air in, it would start sucking air in. And you would have turbines at the input points around this big concrete Colosseum that would start generating power just through the suction of air, like a big vacuum through these ducts. There's nothing, again, saying that you can't do it. And in fact, he's had world-class climatologists who understand how tornadoes and hurricanes are made basically say, yeah, there's nothing stopping us from taking this approach. What's stopping us is people being freaked out with the idea of having all these man-made tornadoes spinning around their communities.
That's understandable, really.
It is understandable, but it's interesting because people might think that these things are going to escape, you know, out of their pen and start to, like, terrorize their community, like, as I say, as Godzilla, in, you know, on Tokyo. And that's not going to happen, like, because basically the fuel for this tornado is the air ducts, the hot air that's being pushed in. And if you want to stop it, you just shut off the air. You can stop it instantly. Unlike a tornado that just appears naturally, this thing is completely predictable and it's completely controllable. But, you know, still, if you want to have a big impact with this approach, you've got to ideally have, you know, hundreds, potentially thousands of these things around the world extracting waste heat from thermal power plants. I don't know, just thought. It's kind of daunting just to think about having thousands of these things spinning all the time. It's a serious challenge, and I honestly don't think this concept will ever get built, but it's a neat thing to think about.
Well, what I found interesting about this one is this is, I think, the only technology that I'm aware of that would actually contribute to global cooling.
Yeah, because one version of this technology is that you could extract the heat from the ocean in the tropics around the equator. You know, and this is far out there, but you'd have this idea of creating these tornadoes positioned and spaced out around the world, basically like a ring, that would suck heat out of the oceans and then push it to the upper atmosphere. And the idea is it would take heat from the oceans, and as you know, the oceans are heating up because of climate change, and it would act as a cooling mechanism for the planet. Of course, that's way out there, and this approach would be more expensive than just taking waste heat from a power plant. But who knows, if we're ever in a crisis and we need to resort to geoengineering to solve our climate crisis, maybe this is one option.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and after a quick break, we'll be back to talk more about clean energy with Tyler Hamilton, author of Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Adventures and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at some of the microscopic organisms that share our planet and occasionally our bodies. We're joined by science writer and blogger Carl Zimmer to talk about his new book, A Planet of Viruses. And we'll speak to ScientificAmerican.com managing editor Philip Yam about the mysterious and nearly indestructible prion. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at SkepticallySpeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest today is Tyler Hamilton, adjunct professor at the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University and writer of the Toronto Star column Clean Break, covering the clean technology and green energy market. We're talking about his book, Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Inventors and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy. Now, what about algae? You wrote about a low-cost method to produce clean-burning ethanol. How does that work?
Well, algae is something that's being considered seriously as a way to produce biofuels, and there's no shortage of companies trying to take this approach. And the approach so far, though, is focused on extracting oil from algae. So the idea is that you grow these things in ponds, you feed them lots of sunlight and CO2 and nutrients, and they'll get all fat like couch potatoes, and then you'll harvest them, and it goes through a process where you're more or less breaking their cell walls and squeezing out the oil. You know, that's one approach, but it's very energy intensive. Just the whole harvesting aspect and the process of extracting the oil is energy intensive. So there's a company that I profiled in the book called Alginol Biofuels. They're based in Florida. And they've decided to focus instead on ethanol, not oil, because ethanol, when it's created by algae, gets released naturally through their cell walls in gaseous form. It's very mobile. So what they do, instead of growing algae and then basically grinding it up and trying to squeeze out its oils, they keep the algae alive for as long as possible. And they give it plenty of sunlight, and they give it lots of CO2 and nutrients, and the algae more or less fart out the ethanol.
You have a way with words, sir.
And so these things release this ethanol in gaseous form under these biophotoreactors. And the reactors are designed such that when the gas rises to the top, you get this condensation. And then the condensation it drips down the sides into these troughs. And so it's all gravity-driven, basically. And the ethanol just gets collected in these little troughs that are on the sides of these little bioreactors, which are designed like miniature greenhouses. And you have to have fields and fields of these things, but their approach, because it's gravity-driven, there's not a lot of high pressures needed to extract stuff, they can produce ethanol for, I think they were telling me last I talked to them, 85 cents a gallon. So it's quite competitive, and they've got huge partners now on board. They've partnered with the refinery giant Valero. They've got a partnership with Dow Chemical, a couple of other big energy players in Europe that haven't been named yet. So they're doing quite well, but it wasn't always that way. The guy who founded this company had the idea back about 20 years ago, as a student at the University of Western Ontario. he realized that cyanobacteria, which actually isn't an algae, it's called a blue-green algae. It can basically behave like algae in the sense that it can perform photosynthesis. And he had the idea that you could manipulate the enzymes in these organisms to produce more ethanol than they normally produce naturally. But at the time, he went around to some of the big oil companies and he pitched the idea, and they were just like, we're not interested. This is like a nutcase idea. Don't bother us. And he was like, well, I'm not going to get anywhere with this. And besides, oil is pretty cheap these days, so there's no incentive for them to look for alternatives. So he just put it on the back burner. He worked with a professor at U of T who kind of fine-tuned the process and just stuck with it over the years. And then it wasn't until oil started to rise and gas prices started to rise around 2006 that he decided, okay, now's the time. I'm going to take it off the shelf and I'm going to run with it. And 5 years later, he's got a fairly thriving company that's well-financed, and they seem to be doing quite well.
We have a question from Paul.
I've read that if farmers were allowed to grow hemp for industrial purposes, it could be a source of energy, both by conversion to biofuels and as a heating turbine turning power source. What are your thoughts?
I think, as I said earlier, it's not going to be a silver bullet approach. It's going to be the silver buckshot approach. So when people try to compare one approach to another, I say, well, why are we comparing and saying we should do this or that? Like, we should do everything. You know, I'm in favor of the all hands on deck approach to dealing with climate change.
Absolutely.
So the hemp thing is a great idea. I mean, I think that when we approach solutions down the road, what we have to do is look at which geography is it best suited for, which industries is it best suited for, because different areas, different people, different industries are going to have different requirements. And as long as we have a big grab bag of different solutions, then I think we're going to be okay.
We have a veritable plethora of questions coming in. This one's from Josh in the chat.
Couldn't that tornado power idea making coal power more economical actually be bad if it leads to more coal plants and less investment in other fuel sources?
Well, that's a good question, because that's the question that people pose to companies trying to do carbon capture and sequestration, right? Because if you build this infrastructure that merely reinforces an existing infrastructure, then you're shooting yourself in the foot if you truly believe that these fossil fuels have to be completely eliminated from our energy system. And yeah, I agree, but the thing is that coal plants are just the most obvious example, but this could work with any kind of industrial plant that generates a large amount of waste heat, whether it's a cement plant, natural gas power plant, a steel plant. There's all sorts of different applications. And of course, there's down the road, there's the ocean-based one that I spoke about. But it's true. But at the same time, coal plants won't shut down overnight, right? We've got hundreds and hundreds of these things operating today. A lot of them still have 20 to 30 years still on them. There won't be a utility that shuts them down tomorrow just because they're told to. So if we can have a technology that allows them to improve the efficiency of those plants now, then I think it's a good short-term solution, especially if it's a cost-effective solution. So I'm open for any idea that allows us to use existing infrastructure that's likely to be around for the next couple of decades, that allows us to use that more efficiently.
And a question from Sasha.
Is there really any such thing as clean coal?
No, I don't think there's any such thing as clean coal. It's an oxymoron. The problem with carbon capture is that it's parasitic. The technology is used to clean up coal and to be able to extract the greenhouse gases from them and compress them, purify them, and bury them underground. That takes a lot of electricity, and I've seen figures saying that you have to burn 25% more coal just to do this. So I think that clean coal is just a way for these existing fossil fuel industries to perpetuate their dominance and to continue along that path, and again, to reinforce and entrench themselves further. I actually like the algae idea because I'm a big proponent of carbon recycling. Instead of continuing to mine fossil fuels and then just pumping the CO2 back underground and actually not knowing whether it's going to stay underground, because there's a lot of issues related to the long-term stability of that solution, I say that we extract carbon from the air and use that to make fuels in the kind of above-ground carbon cycle, rather than using carbon to get more carbon out of the ground, which is what the oil companies want to do, such as with enhanced oil recovery, where you pump carbon underground so that you can get more oil out of aging wells. So to answer your question, and I kind of went off on a tangent there talking about oil, but the
two are related.
The two are related, but I don't think clean coal is going to happen. In fact, I just wrote a story on how there's a reduction in the number of pilot projects now for carbon capture and sequestration. It's too costly. There's no political will to follow through, and I just don't think it's going to happen.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Tyler Hamilton, the author of Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Inventors and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy. Now, this is an email question from Jeff.
Are there any biofuel technologies that are carbon neutral, or is it just burning different stuff?
Yeah, like the carbon neutral stuff is basically cellulosic ethanol. Well, even corn. The problem with corn ethanol, for example, is that a lot of the energy that it takes to grow the corn and to transport it and to process it and to convert it into ethanol, that uses a lot of fossil fuels. And by the time you get the end product, there's considerable doubt that you're creating more energy than you're putting into creating it. But turning switchgrass, for example, into biofuels or using algae to make biofuels, I think I've seen figures ranging from 1 to 5 energy ratio input versus output. So you're putting 1 unit of energy in to get 5 units out, and I think that's heading in the right direction. Now, as far as carbon neutrality goes, the concept, and this is just in an ideal world, but the idea is that you grow this stuff, whether it's switchgrass or algae, you produce a fuel from it, you burn it, it releases the CO2. But the idea is that if you grow this switchgrass back again, it's going to reabsorb the CO2 that you've just released, and then it gets part of this cycle that is supposedly carbon neutral. Now, I don't think it's possible to have 100% carbon neutral, because you're obviously going to have inefficiencies in there, but I think it's possible to head towards that idea. And there are, the reason why I wrote this book is because I'm very optimistic. There's like hundreds of people working on solutions every day around biofuels, around solar, around wind. It's very encouraging, and I've never seen so much innovation going on in my short lifetime, but in talking with people who have been around a lot longer than me in various government labs, the amount of innovation is just stunning. So carbon neutral, I think, is a possible end goal with biofuels.
And a question from Atticus.
I've heard a lot of people claim that oil companies are deliberately trying to stop development of clean energy technologies, sometimes by buying inventors off or threatening them. Is there anything behind it, or is it just conspiracy nonsense?
First, I want to say I like the name Atticus. Awesome name. But as far as is there anything behind that, I do know for a fact that these companies do accumulate a lot of patents. So there's no question that they have the patents. The question is, are they truly sitting on them and trying to prevent them from emerging? And I haven't seen evidence to say that's the case, and in fact, you would think that in this day and age, a company that had some groundbreaking new clean energy technology, and it saw the writing on the wall, it saw issues such as peak oil and energy security, and it knew that you have to find at some point some alternative that's going to be sustainable over the long term, then you'd think that they would try to commercialize that and run with it. So I have a hard time believing that there's some conspiracy theory out there that the big companies are intentionally suppressing clean energy technologies. Now, I'm willing to believe that they're maybe keeping it in their back pocket for a rainy day. Maybe they're preventing them from emerging earlier. But I think that eventually good technologies will see the light. And as things get worse, whether it has to do with climate change or the availability of energy supplies and resources, I think we're going to see more of those ideas shine through.
And this one is from Gold.
The Rossi Engineering Catalyzer, or ECAT, is supposedly in the process of starting a 1 megawatt power station later this month using its energy catalyzer. Any thoughts on this, given the criticism it's received?
Yeah, I've been following this one. There's supposed to be a 1 megawatt power plant designed for, I think, a Norwegian utility at the end of this month. And I think that if they actually go ahead with this demonstration and there's some media there, some outside experts looking at it, I think this could start attracting some attention. There has been criticism to Rossi because he has been and I guess he's been doing small kind of tabletop or controlled lab experiments. And as much as some of the people he's had observing them think that there is something strange happening, he hasn't been able to convince people that it's real yet. So there's a lot of head scratching going on, but it is a very interesting example of something that could end up really wowing us within the next year or two, and possibly by the end of this month. So I would keep an eye on the Rossi experiment. This ECAT technology could be, you know, another example of, and I don't like to call it cold fusion. A lot of people are calling it cold fusion, but in fact, it's just another unknown phenomenon. Something's happening that we can't explain, and a lot of people just have this knee-jerk reaction and they call it cold fusion. But I think it's good. There's people out there still giving it a shot, and this guy, he could actually show us that there's something to be found there.
You're an optimist, sir.
Yes, I am. I have two children. I have to be an optimist.
And one last question from Ashley.
Quacks and cranks are always comparing themselves to Tesla or Galileo, saying that science just has to catch up to their crankpot inventions. Is there an easy way to separate the radical but promising stuff from the stuff that's just bunk all the way down?
No. way to do it. In fact, I address this issue in the book because as a reporter who covers this area, I get approached every day with people coming up with ideas that they think are going to save the world. And quite honestly, I don't have the time to go through them. I don't have the time to go down that rabbit hole with these people and figure out whether they're legit or not. I'm not a scientist, so I don't even have the wherewithal to determine whether they've got something. It really is tough. And in fact, there's a guy I profile in the book who had the task. He had a great job. He had a multi-billionaire come to him and say, "I'm going to give you $20 million or so." I forget the exact amount he gave him. And he says, "You go out and you find like the top whatever 10 crackpot ideas out there. And just give them money. Here, give them $1 million and see what they're going to do with it." And you know, this philanthropist basically said, "You know, I know I'm probably going to lose this money, but we got to just start throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks." But here's the thing: is the criteria that the guy who was given this task used? He said, "I couldn't tell whether any of these technologies were legit or not, but I gave the money to people who came across as reasonable, could articulate their ideas clearly, and actually wrote something down. Like they were organized. They showed that they were trying to run this as a business, and they weren't just somebody in their garage that was scattered and, you know, only showered once every week, and looked disheveled all the time, right?" He wanted some kind of sign that these people were organized. So at some point you have to impose some criteria for taking these people seriously. And perhaps there's going to be people who slip through the cracks, but you have to have faith, and I have faith that if ideas are strong enough, they will eventually float to the top.
And on that note, we are completely out of time. Thanks for being here, Tyler.
My pleasure.
You can find links to Tyler Hamilton and Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Inventors and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You'll also find links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, as well as to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. and I'm your host, Desiree Schell.